Greetings, everybody. Those of you who are online, those of you coming here in Parramatta at the Temple of Humanity, and we are here to express our devotion to the Triple Gem, to practice meditation together, and to discuss the Buddha's teachings. And I'm going to continue with my series on dependent origination. And let us begin with chanting the recollection to the Triple Gem. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Iti piso bhagavā arahaṃ sammā sambuddho. Vijja charana sampanno sugato lokavidu. Anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi. Sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati. Svakato bhagavata dhammo. Sandhyetiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pachatam veditabbo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho. Nyaya patipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho. Samichi patipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho. Yadidam chattari purisa yugani. Atta purisa pungala. Esa bhagavato sahavaka sangho. Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakirneyo anjali karaniyo anutaram punyaketam lokasati. All right, very good. So we come together today on the land of the Parramattigal people of the Darug Nation, to whom we pay respect and honour. And we are here to lift our minds up to that which we consider to be the highest, that which is the best that we can be. So one of the things which is so fundamental to Buddhism that it's almost implicit. Hi, welcome. Welcome, you're here just in time. Come, lucky you found us. We're a bit bit homeless between places at the moment, so we're always glad when somebody manages to find out where we are. So I was just starting with talking about meditation and talking about how when we practice meditation, we lift our mind up to what we consider to be the highest. We call this citta bhavana. And we're good. I think we're good. All right. Good enough for you. It's a nice quiet street, though. So, I don't know. I feel like that kind of the way that the world is, or the way that the values of the world has become, is something which is quite other to what the Buddha is teaching. So how things tend to go in the world is that it tends to be like, well, we're going to like cater for your desires, like whatever it is that you want, we're going to try to give that to you. And the more and more we go down this road, we seem to live in, like, we have like these kind of hyper-specific niches of desires that are going to be catered for. Welcome, please come in. Nilushi, please don't be sorry for showing up to the Dhamma talk. You're always welcome. It's an amazing thing. Come in. We're in this world where everything is pulling us away from the Dhamma and pulling us towards more desires, more wanting, more attachments. And so for anybody to show up to a Dhamma talk is, I think, really quite an amazing thing in this world. And there's this kind of like this idea that we're going to be happy if only we can be given what we want. So we get these very kind of like it's kind of crazy, right? So we're told that like we live in an age of like technology and innovation and everything like that. And it's great. We have so much innovation. Like we all have like mobile phones these days, except like all the mobile phones are the same, you know, and we all drive cars, but, you know, all the cars are the same. And we all have like toothbrushes. And like how many times have you seen ads for toothbrushes with like the, you know, this is the latest shoopty-doopty toothbrush that's going to clean your teeth like even better than anything else, like, and they're just the same as they were when I was a kid, you know, like literally no different. So all of these things, like there's this constant churn at like breakfast cereals. It's, come on, man. I'm sounding like a grumpy old man here, but you know, we had Weet-Bix, we were happy, you know. And all of these kind of choices and all of these things to try to trick your mind into thinking, oh, yeah, somehow this will be the one. This will make me happy or make me satisfied. So, and it's all like catering to that thing. And, of course, I'm talking here about fairly trivial things, but also there's a lot that's a lot darker, right, where people are trying to manipulate you into feeling bigotry, into feeling hatred. And we've seen the anti-immigrant marches in Australia. It's like, you know, crazy, right? The literally immigrants have done nothing bad in Australia and have created this incredible culture that we're living in that's amazing. And there's like all of this kind of stoked up feeling of anger based on nothing but years of ingrained bigotry. We could talk about this for ages. My point being that even though the world wants to drag us down to what is least in us, it wants to activate that which is most mean and small and limited and harmful. And the Buddha worked in exactly the opposite way. He didn't deny that those things are true. He said, yes, we all have greed, hate, and delusion. Yes, no denying that. And all of those things are part of who we are, and we can't proceed in our spiritual path without acknowledging that. But he also said that that's not all that we are. And what he said was that we are responsible for what we do with what we have. We have, yes, the potential for greed, hate, and delusion, undeniable, and we can follow that path. But we also have the potential for love and the potential for letting go and for generosity. We have the potential for wisdom. Amazing, right? Amazing how the Buddha saw in each of us that potential. Remember how the Buddha, first of all, didn't want to teach the Dhamma. He's like, this lot, they're hopeless. I'm not going to even bother. Why would I even bother? I'll just go off and do some meditation. I'll be fine. And everyone else will fare on according to their karma. Yeah. And that's a very, very, to me, it's a very relatable moment in the Buddha's biography. Like, why wouldn't you, right? He's not going to suffer. The world has made its choices and it's going to fall into those things. But then he saw that there is that potential. So the word we use for that potential in Buddhism is indriya. Right? Indriya means something like a spiritual potential. We translate it as a faculty. So it's something that that is inside human beings. And, of course, to different degrees. And one of the things that I feel is like a misperception within the Buddhist community or Buddhist practitioners. When we sit down to meditate, we are confronted with the reality of our own hindrances. We're confronted with a mind that wanders and doesn't want to sit still. We're confronted with the fact that we want to be at peace and yet our own mind does not want us to be at peace. And because of that, we somehow have this perception inside us that we're not very good at all of this. We're not very good at meditation. We're not very good at, you know, oh, I'm not like a real serious practitioner or I can't really very far or anything like that. And we underestimate our own potential. But I want you to all know that all of you who have shown up for tonight, you're the ones that the Buddha was thinking about when he said there are those with little dust in their eyes. The ones with much dust in their eyes didn't show up tonight. They went somewhere else and did something else. Yeah. The ones who are here are the ones with little dust in their eyes and with the spiritual potential to develop and grow in the path. Yeah? That's why you're here and that's what you are capable of doing. So please don't underestimate your own capacities. Don't trap yourself in the thoughts of the past. Don't trap yourself in the perceptions of who you are and what you are capable of. Because each one of us is capable of incredible things. And those incredible things are things that there is nothing standing in our way to realizing those incredible things. It's not like a university degree. We don't have to like do first year and then second year and so on until finally we get it at the end. The Dhamma is truth. And the truth is there all the time. And all we have to do is realize the truth. There's literally nothing standing between us and the realization of the Dhamma except for our own hindrances and defilements. If we let go of those things, the truth is present already. So I just want you to know that that truth is just a veil away. That's it. It's just a mist. It's just a shimmer. And if you can see clearly, then all of that suffering can fall away. So the way that we do this, the way we learn to do this is through meditation. And the number one thing we need to do in meditation is what the Buddha, what the Zen people call the beginner's mind. So that means that when we go into meditation, we tend to be trapped in our perceptions of what's happened in the past. So many of you may have heard, I've given a few talks in the last few years on the Madhupindika Sutta, Majjhima 18, where the Buddha talks about how our perceptions and our proliferations tend to harden and create this fixed idea of that person who is who I am. And that we're not really aware of that, like we act out from that, but we're not really aware of what that is. And so we have this idea of who we are, and it's something that we kind of learned as we were kids, right? We're growing up and we learned about ourselves, right? I remember I had one conversation with somebody at school. I was probably in primary school or something like that. And this kid said to me, oh yeah, but you're an intellectual. I'm like, what am I? So it was the first time someone called me an intellectual and probably about the last time as well. But anyway, so it's like a moment where you think, oh, is that what I am? You know, and when you're a kid and when you're growing up, you don't know what you are. Right? And people put you in these categories. Oh, you're a boy, you're a girl, you're smart, you're dumb, you're good at sports, you're not good at sports, you're artistic, whatever. And there's all of these things that say that's who you are. And maybe that is who you are. Right? But then what you are inside you has a potential to be free, regardless of any of those things. Doesn't matter what your background is, doesn't matter what your race is, your gender, your sexuality, doesn't matter how old you are, what kind of education you've had, doesn't matter what your income bracket is. Right? Doesn't matter what your favorite music is, or doesn't matter anything like that, doesn't matter. You have potential in you to be free. Yeah. This is a really amazing thing in Buddhism, and this is the promise that the Buddha made. I would not have taught you this unless I knew it to be true. It is possible to let go of that which is unwholesome and develop that which is wholesome. And if it is possible to do that, that means that we can all realize the Dhamma. So let's do some meditation for the next 20 minutes or so. Okay, so sitting quietly. And allowing the mind to settle back and relax inside the body. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Letting the breath calm you down. Letting that cool, soothing energy of your breathing bring your mind, your heart, your body to stillness and peace. mindfully breathing in and mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, 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 mindfully breathing out. Letting everything settle, letting everything calm. Feeling that state of nature of just being at peace, still as a mountain pool. As still as the forest at sunset. As still as the sky after a storm. And now coming near to the end of the meditation. And drawing the mind back from the breath and returning to the senses, returning to just the ordinary state of mind. And taking a minute to check back, asking yourself, how was that? How did the mind change? What's the mind like now compared to how it was then? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. Excellent. So thanks, everybody, for that. And especially thanks to the person who ended our meditation with something. It wasn't quite like a bell tone, but it was certainly a tone. Anyway, let's have a break for 5 minutes. Have a break for 5 minutes and then come back for some more dependent origination. Awesome. Paticca Samuppada. Paticca Samuppada. So a quick question from Marian. Marian asks about another sutta in 3.100. So there's a sutta that talks about the kaya bhavana, developing physical, which I'm translating as developing physical endurance. Basically what it means is the ability to put up with like heat and cold and insects and discomfort and all of that kind of thing. So it's not really about anything else. That's about. All right. So fine, let us go for today for the teachings on dependent origination. And some of you have been here for the entire course on dependent origination, some of you not. For those of you who have not been here for the whole course since the beginning, I am so very sorry for what is about to happen, okay? So, and by the way, if I can just remind folks online, if it's possible for you to turn your cameras on, then that's appreciated. So we are building up on the knowledge that we learnt from the beginning. In the first week, we did the basic survey of dependent origination. The second one, we looked at the dependent origination in comparison to creation mythologies from different backgrounds. Then we took a deep dive into the terminology, the background, or the grammar of dependent origination. And then we have been looking at some of the shorter suttas on dependent origination that illuminate different aspects. Along the way, we've been treating dependent origination as the Buddha's explanation of how rebirth happens without a soul. That is how this world evolves and changes as an endless stream of conditions, starting back in the beginningless past, streaming through into the endless future. And that we are participating in this stream, but we are not subject to it or determined by it, but we are actively involved in it and creating and moving that stream along. And so this is that idea of dependent origination. It's a very dynamic, very relational, very fluid way of looking at the human condition with a sense of like profound appreciation for the depth of the existential situation in which we find ourselves. Through the teachings, one of the things that we've looked at is the way that in the sequence of 12 factors of dependent origination, there are various kinds of parallels and synonyms. And so the factors can be swapped in and out or changed around in different ways, all of which will reveal some kind of aspect of the process of dependent origination. One of the themes that came up in last week, we discussed the Sayankata and Parankata, made by oneself and made by another. And we looked at the way that if you looked closely at how those terms are used within the Indian philosophical context, that they fall back on or they rely on the notions of eternalism and annihilationism. And so there's this kind of theme that dependent origination is a middle way between saying that everything is just eternal, or at least your soul is just eternal, the world is eternal, the cosmos is eternal, and it just is, right? Or that you're just here for a short period of time and then you just stop and that's it. So these are considered by the Buddha two extremes. And the Buddha instead proposed this idea of this network and flow of conditions where things are never exactly the same, nor are they completely different, but they are constantly mutating, transforming, altering, and crucially, vitalizing and energizing that flow in the future. So we're not just, it's not like falling into a river, but we are like, we are actively creating the flow of the river as we are in it. Why is my screen so dark, Bhante? Because the light here is dark, and the light, we've only got one small light behind me, that's why. Yeah, so there you go. Moving along. Okay, so for today, I wanted to look mostly at one particular sutta, and that's called the Kacchanagata Sutta. The Kacchanagata Sutta is your favorite sutta nerd's favorite sutta. Okay, so it's the sutta that was famously quoted and named by Nagarjuna in his Mula Madhyamaka Karika, the most famous and profound philosophical treatise in the history of Buddhism. And it is an endlessly fascinating discourse because it deals with themes that are familiar from Buddhism, from elsewhere in the Dhamma, but it does it in quite a striking and powerful way. That's one of these suttas that's both very intellectually stimulating and also quite human and quite moving. It's a difficult sutta to translate. One of the reasons why it's been, you know, attracted so much commentary and so on is because it is not easy to translate. And but I'm not sure how much we'll get into those details. But before we get on to the Kacchanagata Sutta, we're going to look at the Lokayatika Sutta, because this gives us some essential context for the Kacchanagata Sutta. And Lokayatika Sutta is one of those very simple suttas that on the face of it doesn't seem to be saying all that much. Then let us briefly read through the sutta. So this is Samyutta Nikaya 12.48. I put the sutta in the chat for those of you online. At Savatthi then, a Brahman cosmologist went up to the Buddha, seated at one side. He said to the Buddha, "Worthy Gotama, does all exist?" The Buddha replies, "All exists. This is the oldest cosmology, Brahman." "Then does all not exist?" "All does not exist. This is the second cosmology." "Well, is all oneness?" "All is oneness. This is the third cosmology." "Then is all expansiveness?" "All is expansiveness. This is the fourth cosmology." Avoiding these two extremes, the realized one teaches by the middle way. Ignorance is a requirement for choices. Choice is a requirement for consciousness. That is how this whole mass of suffering originates. When ignorance fades away and ceases with nothing left over, choices cease. When choices cease, consciousness ceases. That's how this entire mass of suffering ceases. When he said this, the Brahman cosmologist said to the Buddha, "Excellent, worthy Gotama, excellent. From this day forth, may the worthy Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life." All right, so like I said, short sutta, apparently very simple, but one of those little suttas that requires some fairly deep context to start to make sense of it. First thing is, what do we mean when we say we're talking about a cosmologist, right? So the word for cosmology is Lokayatika. And this is a word that has been caused a lot of confusion in Buddhist scholarly circles for the last century or so, largely because it came to have the meaning of materialist. So in later Indian philosophy, a Lokayata was somebody who espoused a materialist philosophy, right? So loka means a world. So it's like a worldly philosopher, right? So sometimes, like today, we might say like a secularist, right? So if you're a secularist or materialist, you'd be called a lokayatika. Okay, fine. And so for quite a long time, then the Buddha, the Pali Suttas were read with that meaning. But turns out that that's a later meaning, and that's not what lokayatika means at the time of the Buddha. So literally, the word loka means the world or the cosmos, right? And the ayata, the word ayata means extent, yeah? Right? So the extent literally means the extent of the cosmos. That's literally what the word lokayata means. And in the Buddha's, in the suttas, we find frequently that people will discuss things like, is the universe infinite or not infinite? Right? Is the world eternal or not eternal? Right? So this is the extent of, literally, the extent of the world. Yeah? And so the lokayatas were philosophers who speculated about those kinds of questions. Yeah. How big is the universe? You know, I mean, these are interesting questions and physicists still debate them. How old is the universe? When did it start? How long does it go on? Right? What does it mean for the universe to be rather than to not be? Right? How did existence come about? Right? So all of these kind of fundamental questions is what we'd call lokayata. And this lokayata Brahman, we don't know his name, but we know just know his field of study, comes along and says, does all exist? Okay, sabbamati. Now, same phrase, sabbamati, is what we find in the Kacchayanagata Sutta. So that's why I'm introducing that here. Okay, so this is giving us a clue. Let me repeat, all exists. This is the oldest cosmology, Brahman. Right? Literally the oldest cosmology. Yeah. So I'm just going to stop for a minute and think, what did the Buddha mean by that? Right? What does it mean to say it's the oldest cosmology? And I've read lots of stuff on the suttas over the years. And I can't recall. I may be wrong on this. Okay. So please don't quote me on this. But I can't recall anyone who actually thought he was literally meaning the oldest cosmology. Right. So we can, people like interpret it like metaphorically or like in terms of a philosophical sense or something like that. But I honestly can't recall that anybody has said, oh, he probably means literally the oldest philosophy, the oldest cosmology. As it happens, we do have the literal oldest cosmology in India. It's in the Rig Veda. It's called the Nausadhya Sukta. It's Rig Veda 10.129. And the Rig Veda 10.129 begins, the non-existent did not exist, nor did the existent exist at that time. That's literally the first line of the oldest cosmology, right? So when the Buddha is speaking here to this Brahman, now notice how we use, notice the methodology that we want to use here. I want to point this out to you. When I'm pointing out these connections, I'm not just pulling stuff out of midair, all right? The Buddha's talking to a lokayata Brahman, right? And the lokayata Brahman is proposing to him his philosophy, and the Buddha is responding to that. So this is why we can look at it and say, well, we should look in the Vedic philosophy for what they're talking about, because clearly that is what they're talking about. I want to make this point because it's easy to sort of imagine that these connections are just kind of made arbitrarily or something like that. But all the time when I'm doing this and doing this work, you're always looking, well, what does the text want to tell us? At this most basic level, it's pointing to the oldest cosmology. And the oldest cosmology is the Nausadhya Sukta in the Rig Veda. There's a few other hymns in the Rig Veda that have a similar kind of thing, but Nausadhya Sukta is the main one. Also, bear in mind that even though it's the oldest cosmology, it's one of the youngest suttas, or youngest hymns in the Rig Veda. All right. So Nausadhya Sukta is from the last layer of the Rig Veda. So it was composed maybe 400 years before the Buddha, something like that, 400-500 years, something. Older parts of the Rig Veda are much older than that. All right. So this just to get an idea of what the framework is. So we're talking about a branch of learning and study that we first expressed in terms of existence and non-existence. Yeah. First one, all exists, right? The non-existent did not exist, nor did the existence exist at that time. In fact, I should read the whole of that. And one second, do I have that here? I'm not sure if I have. Give me one second. I do actually have it here. Okay, so I'm going to pull that up. If you give me one second, I'm going to read the whole of the Nausadhya Sukta for you because I refer to this a number of times. It's extremely important for understanding Indian philosophy, and it's also an amazing piece of composition. So this is reading from the Jamison Brereton translation. It's a modern translation of the Rig Veda, which I have been referring to frequently in my studies and also reading through. Rig Veda is not Dan Brown. Like, you're not going to just get through it on a flight or something like that. Okay, so here's the Nausadhya Sukta. So I'll read from the Jamison Brereton translation. The non-existent did not exist, nor did the existent exist at that time. There existed neither the airy space nor heaven beyond. What moved back and forth? From where and in whose protection? Did water exist? A deep depth. Death did not exist, nor deathlessness then. There existed no sign of night nor day. You're getting the sense that exist is kind of a theme here, right? Again, when the Buddha's referring to that, he's clearly harking back to something that both he and the Brahman cosmologist would have understood. That's what he's referring to. That one breathed without wind by its independent will. There existed nothing else beyond that. Darkness existed, hidden by darkness in the beginning. All this was a signless ocean. What existed as a thing coming into being concealed by emptiness, that one was born by the power of heat. Then in the beginning, from thought there evolved desire, which existed as the primal semen. Searching in their hearts through inspired thought, poets found the connection of the existent in the non-existent. Okay? Searching in their hearts through inspired thought, poets found the connection of the existent in the non-existent. Okay, remember, these guys were like all on drugs. Okay? Do not forget that, right? Okay? Their cord was stretched. They were taking this soma. They were like, wow, the existent and the non-existent. All right? This cord was stretched across. Did something exist below it? Did something exist above? Right? A cord stretched across, something below, something above. So you're establishing like a structure and a hierarchy in the universe, right? So later on, of course, the cord below would have been the earth and above would be the heavens. But now, was there anything above that? Division existed before they did. There exist places of semen and there existed greatnesses. Okay, so the places of semen, the fathers, greatnesses are the pregnant women. There was independent will below, offering above. Who really knows? Who here can proclaim it? Who shall proclaim it? From where it was born? From where this creation? The gods are on this side of the creation. So then who does know from where it came to be? This creation from where it came to be, if it was produced or not, he who is the overseer of this world in the furthest heaven, he surely knows, or maybe he does not know. Right? So this is literally the oldest cosmology. And so you can see, first of all, the Buddha's referring to all exists, all does not exist, right? And because from the questions from the Brahman. Now you can see that Nausadhya Sutta is reflecting very profoundly about those things, about the nature of existence, right? But it also doesn't want to be too clear-cut. Like part of its whole thing, darkness is hidden by darkness, yeah? It doesn't want to pretend that these things, that it's got a straightforward account of what happened. Remember, we looked at the Genesis, you know, and there's very kind of clear-cut. This is what happened, one thing after the other. Nausadhya Sukta, not so clear-cut. So the Buddha, first of all, so the Brahman proposes, does all exist? So the Brahman is now trying to interpret this out and make a sort of coherent philosophy Okay, is it all, does all exist? No. Does all not exist? Also no, right? Is all oneness? So here, notice how one is also a theme in the Nausadhya Sutta, right? So after talking about existence and non-existence, the first verse, right? The first verse is existence and non-existence. Death does not exist, or deathlessness then. That's the beginning of the second verse. The halfway through the second verse, that one breathed without wind by its independent will. Yeah, that one was born by the power of heat. So again, the Brahman says all is oneness, is all oneness, right? Right. So this is another thing. Then is all expansiveness. So the Pali word here is putu. And so putu is used in the sense of a broad expanse of waters, a broad expanse of the cause which is stretched across. This is a synonym for that, right? So the putu means like the stretched out, the world which is stretched out and expansive. So I give a few examples. So the one is the immortal divinity, right? And that the one to which there is no second, whereas the putu, the expansiveness, is this world which is full of diversity. And in the Rig Veda, it is the expanse of the earth and waters. It is also has sexual connotations. It's an ample womb, or, and you're going to like this, it's also a fat ass. Okay, so if you have expansive buttocks, also the same. So these things also all having that same idea of the broadness of the worldly realities. So oneness suggests the divinity that underlies all. Expansiveness suggests the broad world on which humans live. So in the sacrifice, the sacrificial cake, which is like a pounded cake of rice, of flour, should be spread expansively, but not too expansively, because if at the sacrifice we spread the cake out too expansively, it will become human and therefore mortal. Right? But think about it. It makes sense. If you have a cake, right, like a pancake, you want to roll it thin but not too thin, because if you make it too thin, it will break up and disappear. You see? So that makes it mortal. Yeah. So, okay, so these are some of the connotations which are being drawn on in this idea of the Nausadhya Sutta. Right? And so it's about creation. It's about creation of the cosmos, but it's also about human creation and human life, right? And it's about pregnancy. It's about giving birth. It's about all of those things, which is part of like how that process of existence and non-existence and oneness and many comes to be. Right, I mean, pregnancy is also that process, right? The woman is one and then she is many. And so this also is part of that process of how creation comes to be. So in the Brahmanical system, these distinctions are not distinct, right? The cosmology and the biology and the organic and life and all of these things all reflect the same process. So this is the Lokayatika Sutta. And the Buddha's response to the Brahman cosmologist. So Scott says, and here's me thinking my tripped out revelations were something original. I know, right? I know, it's very disappointing. I know the thing is that like the great psychedelic bands of the 60s, they had Rig Vedic poets had the discipline and the art to transform their tripped out imagery into great art, which lasted down through the ages. So that's really what makes the difference. But there's something to it, right? I mean, I'm being facetious here and I'm not meaning to be disrespectful, because I genuinely think that the Rig Veda is one of the great accomplishments of humanity. But it's an accomplishment of humanity in all of its fullness. You know, to me, it's not a sacred text, but it's a very human text, which is full of all of those, you know, to me, like that note of doubt and questioning in that sutta is where we see that humanity speaking down through the ages, you know, rather than something that's coming as a doctrinally approved text. Anyway, so that's the Nausadhya Sutta. And I know that I've referred to that particular sutta and read from that sutta before and so on, but I'm not going to apologize for it. Fine, moving on. So now we're going to come to the Katthanagatta Sutta. And one of the reasons for reading the Lokayatika Sutta first was because the Katthanagatta Sutta then draws on some of the same concepts, right? And let us now read through this one. Okay, so then Atsavati, Venerable Katthanagatta, went up to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Sir, they speak of this thing called right view. How is right view defined? Katthana, this world mostly relies on the dual notions of existence and non-existence." Right? Yeah, loko, right? So the loko is the same word we had in the previous sutta, the loko, the cosmos, the world, existence and non-existence. But for one who, first of all, I just want to pause that. I'm going to read through the sutta and I'm not going to comment on every line. But first of all, just think about that as a response to that question, like what's right view? And the Buddha says, the world mostly relies on these ideas of existence and non-existence, right? It's a really interesting response. Yeah? The Buddha could have said, well, right view is the Four Noble Truths. Right? That's the standard response. But clearly he was wanting to do something different here. Okay. For one who truly sees the origin of the world with right understanding, the concept of non-existence regarding the world does not occur. For one who truly sees the cessation of the world with right understanding, the concept of existence regarding the world does not occur. This world is for the most part shackled by getting involved, grasping, and insisting. But if for all that getting involved and grasping, mental fixation and insistence and underlying tendency, this person does not get attracted, grasp, and fixate on the thought, myself, they'll have no doubt or uncertainty that what arises is just suffering arising, and what ceases is just suffering ceasing. Their knowledge of this is independent of others. That is how right view is defined. All exists, this is one extreme. All does not exist, this is the second extreme. Avoiding these two extremes, the realized one teaches by the middle way. Ignorance is a requirement for choices. Choice is a requirement for consciousness. That's how this entire mass of suffering originates. When ignorance fades away and ceases with nothing left over, choices cease. When choices cease, consciousness ceases. That is how this entire mass of suffering ceases. All right. So when I read this, every time I read this sutta, you know, I spent so much time with it, then every time I read it, I'm struck anew by the insights that it's presenting. And it's presenting like things that we find all throughout Buddhism that are very familiar, and yet somehow the Buddha is speaking in a way that is quite distinctive. Obviously, it's to do with, you know, Katthanagatta and his own, you know, needs at that time. So this was somehow spoke to that. We don't have too much context for that. Okay, so let's go through sort of bit by bit, break it down a little bit. How is right view defined? So that's the first question, right? Now let's bear in mind, remember that right view is usually defined in terms of the Four Noble Truths, but we can also define right view by understanding any of the main Dhamma, because understanding the five aggregates or understanding dependent origination itself, right? So there's many different ways we can talk about right view. But when the Buddha talked about right view in terms of a realization, then he was talking about stream entry. So a stream enter is the one who internalizes and directly sees that truth that we call right view, and then they can't have wrong view after that. So there's these two ideas, two things what we mean by right view. So on the one hand, right view is like the concept of the Dhamma that the Buddha taught and which we consider to be the correct way of seeing things according to the Dhamma, right? That's a conventional sense of right view. But there's also the vision of the Dhamma that the stream enterer has, where they see the essence of what right view is, okay? So world mostly relies on the dual notions of existence and non-existence. All right, so again, we can find a source for this. So in the Shatapada Brahmana, and again, just to remind you of the context, for those of you who've been around will remember this, but for those of you who are new, I mentioned before that the Rig Veda, the text in the Rig Veda, we just quoted the Nausadhya Sukta, that's the oldest text in India and probably the oldest text of Aryan culture. And that poem that we just read was probably from about 800 BC or 900 BC, something vaguely around that time. All these dates are very speculative. The Shatapada Brahmana is after that. So the Shatapada Brahmana is in between the Rig Veda and the Buddha, right? So it was written as a text by Brahman or composed as a text by Brahman ritualists who wanted to systematize and philosophically interpret the practice of their rituals and sacrifices that they were doing. And the tradition of the Shatapada Brahmana is the tradition in which the Buddha studied before his enlightenment under his former teachers, right? So he many times in the suttas, that is what I'm finding as I'm going through and analyzing these things, that most of the time when you find a connection with the suttas and some pre-Buddhist text, most of the time it's with the Shatapada Brahmana tradition. Okay. The Buddha is referring to a widely held belief which can be traced to the saying, "This is twofold, there is no third, truth and falsehood. The gods are truth, humans are falsehood." So this is quoted a few times in the Shatapada Brahmana, saying it was quite a well-known saying. All right, so here we remember the Buddha said, this world mostly relies on the dual notions, right? Dvaya nisito relies on the dvaya, right, the duality of existence and non-existence. And then the Shatapada Brahmana literally says there is this duality, there is no third. And it says that those duality is satya and andrita. Now, these are different terms than we find in the suttas. So the Sanskrit has satya, truth, right? Pali has ati, right? But they both basically mean the same thing, right? What is true, what is real, from the same roots. The Sanskrit has andrita, meaning again, meaning what is false or what is untrue. Yeah, so Pali doesn't really use the word andrita; it's only used in the Vedic tradition. But that's a standard pair in the Sanskrit. But the Pali has ati and nati. But nonetheless, clearly, it's a reference to that particular passage, which gives us a mode of interpreting things, okay? And let me read again from that Sanskrit passage. This is twofold, there is no third, truth and falsehood, or reality and unreality. The gods are truth, humans are falsehood, okay? Interesting equation that's making there. The gods are truth, humans are falsehood, right? Why are the gods true? Because they are immortal. They live forever, so they are truly real, whereas human life is a lie. Because we believe that we're going to live forever. We believe that this is real and true and lasting and meaningful, but then we take our last breath and it's all gone. So this world somehow is illusional, is illusory. Yeah. So for example, in the Atharva Veda, another early pre-Buddhist text, who placed truth in him? Who falsehood? Who mortality? Who immortality? Yeah. Again, notice that kind of sense of wonder. Who placed truth, existence? Who placed falsehood, non-existence? Who placed mortality? Who immortality? So these ideas are very closely linked. Existence, truth, reality, closely linked with the idea of eternal existence. Yeah. Whereas falsehood, unreality, annihilation, always very closely linked with the idea that we are going to come to an end and there will be nothing more. So the Theravada tradition always interprets these two options, these two opposites, existence and non-existence, as being eternalism and annihilationism. Right? That's the standard Theravada interpretation. It's also the interpretation of Nagarjuna. So it's a standard interpretation within the Buddhist tradition, actually. It's normally the way the Buddhists have seen this. Existence means eternally existing. It's a very characteristic way of thinking about it. Like there's something innate and absolute in the idea of existence. It's very difficult to convey that in English because we don't really think about existence in the same way. But it's the idea that if something truly is, then it must be truly forever. Is transcends being, transcends time. Yeah. Whereas if something, when we say something doesn't exist, it's not saying that it's just not there ever. It's saying that it doesn't exist in that sense. It comes to an end. Its existence is untrue. It's false. Yeah. So again, you can see this in a way is drawing on those ambiguities that we find right back to the Nasadiya Sukta, right? Is what darkness existed then. What does it mean to say that darkness, if there's no light, what does it mean to say there's no darkness? Because darkness is just the absence of light. Yeah. So the idea of existence and non-existence is somewhat, when you look at it cosmologically, is mysterious and actually starts to break down. Yeah. And we saw that again in the Nasadiya Sukta, who can say whether it really began with existence or with non-existence. So the Buddha, of course, famously said that there's no known beginning to samsara, right? The pubbakoti napanyayati. And that phrase, there's no known beginning, again, is another one of these phrases a bit difficult to translate. I was just reviewing this the other day, and Bhikkhu Bodhi has, there's no knowable beginning, okay? And to me, that oversteps the Pali just a little bit, because the Pali is anamataga, so it's a past participle. Amata, unknown, right? It doesn't quite say it's not knowable, right? I mean, it doesn't say it is knowable, but the Buddha said it is unknown. I mean, we assume that if it's unknown to the Buddha, then it's probably unknowable, right? But it's kind of interesting, right? That's almost like that veil or that darkness that was affirmed in the Nasadiya Sukta is the same as that which was affirmed by the Buddha. Okay, so fine. Let us move on. Any questions on that? But before we go on, I can see Venerable Pekka's scratching her head. That's excellent. That's exactly the kind of response that I'm looking for here. How are we going? Any questions from anyone? Yes. Yes, he's a bhikkhu. Yeah.
Because he's answering is different to the way he answered to the Asela Kachitra.
Right. Yes.
He's direct.
That's right, yeah. Now, because we don't really know too much about his background, Kachanagata's background, but, you know, his name is a Brahmin caste name, so presumably he has that background, right? Even though it's not as explicit as in the other sutta. That's why I introduced that other sutta first, to show it was definitely introduced in that context. So you assume with this case, I mean, just because someone's got a Brahmin name or a Brahmin background doesn't really mean that they know anything about Brahminism, right? Just the same, someone's from a Buddhist background doesn't necessarily mean they know anything about Buddhism. But in this case, presumably he does, right? So this is, but it's also interesting that the same sutta is quoted to Channa by Ananda. Yeah, after the first council. So it's kind of curious as well. Anyway. Okay. Fine. So here we go. So now going to comment on the next part. For one who truly sees the origin of the world with right understanding, the concept of non-existence regarding the world does not occur. So this is a very beautiful and very insightful way of putting it. See, remember that when we contemplate in meditation, right, when we see especially when we're doing Vipassana meditation, one of the first things people will say, you watch rise and fall, right? Everything is passing. You watch the impermanence of things, yeah? The impermanence of everything that's passing, every thought that's passing, every memory, every mood, every feeling is passing, yeah? And you watch the rise of it, your persistence of it, you watch the fall of it. But here the Buddha is making this very interesting observation that rise and fall actually have quite some different kind of functions within the Dhamma. When you watch the arising of something, right? Think about this. You're watching you're watching things coming into being. Yeah, then you're not going to be thinking about how everything is going to be ending. You're thinking about what is coming to be. And it, when you think about that, you can see this almost like also as like a psychological approach to doing Vipassana meditation. Like if you tend towards that nihilistic point of view, right? Everything is bad, everything's going to fall apart, it's all doom and gloom, so on and so forth, then you need to look at the origination of things, yeah? Focus more on the arising of things in your meditation, but also outside of meditation. And when you see the arising of things, then you're not going to be obsessed with the non-existence. On the other hand, if you tend to get overly attached to things, and then for example you're getting overly attached to what it's going to be like in the future or these kinds of things, then you can start to watch the cessation of things. Yeah, you can start, what is the ending of it? Yeah, and this is something that can be done as just a very simple contemplation. Yeah, you can do that when you get your meal. You can say, oh, I've got this meal, it's delightful, it's delicious. What's it going to look like in 20 minutes? Right? And you don't have to go weird about it, right? You can still eat your meal and enjoy it, but it's like, oh, okay, yeah, that's just that. Yeah. And so you're not obsessed with it. You're not caught up in your attachment to these things. Yeah? So it's really interesting to see the Buddha's using that arising and ceasing, connecting with these ideas of existence and non-existence. And so we can, the one who truly sees the origin of the world with right understanding, the concept of non-existence regarding the world does not occur. So we can paraphrase that. When a person sees that they're in the context of dependent origination, if a person sees that their current actions are generating future lives, it is no longer possible to think that this life is all there is, right? So we're seeing that there are causes, that they're origination of things. And so we begin to realize that actually things just don't just stop. There actually is a potency there. And then when someone who truly sees the cessation of the world with right understanding, the concept of existence, existence regarding the world does not occur. So then when someone, if you see the ending of craving and the karma that generate future lives, you realize that there's no such thing as an eternal soul. And so that's a paraphrase of that. All right, so then the next part. This world is for the most part shackled by getting involved, grasping, and insisting. All right, so these particular phrases express a kind of a process, right? So getting involved, upaya is like approaching, right? So upaya is like getting, I'm going to get involved in that. I'm going to have a look at it. I'm going to approach it. Maybe you walk past a shop. Oh, that looks nice. So you approach it, you get involved in it, grasp in it. Ooh, that's nice, yeah. And then insisting, it's my precious. Right? So that's how that process goes on. So the Buddha is talking about the world. Remember, again, here talking about the world, right? The origin of the world, cessation of the world. The world mostly relies on the notions of existence and non-existence. Now the Buddha is saying the world is, for the most part, shackled by getting involved, grasping, and insisting. So the idea of insisting, abhinivesa, especially has a meaning in terms of insisting on views. So if you have like a dogmatic insistence, only I am right and everybody else is wrong, then this is what's called abhinivesa. And then in the next sentence, we also find a similar set of dhammas, but it's also expanded with it adds the idea of mental fixation, cetasa adhyatana, and underlying tendency. So with the underlying tendency, the defilements become so ingrained that it's no longer conscious, but it underlies your choices, whether they're conscious or not. Okay, so again, this world is for the most part shackled by getting involved, grasping, and insisting. That's where we are at. Okay? Hasn't got better since the Buddha's day, right? Has not got better. But if, now this is, this the next sentence is the most difficult one to translate. Oh my God, if I told you the amount of time that I spent trying to sort all this out, it's ridiculous. But one thing that in the translation, which I think is key, and I'll just mention this briefly for all of the Pali nerds here. So the text begins Tan Chayang, which is tongue. Tongue is referring back to the previous set of defilements. And we know that that's, and the C in there, cha, is short for chair, if, rather than cha, and ayang is pointing forward to the what's coming later in the sentence. That's what tan chayang is doing here. Why do we know that? Because there's a Sanskrit version of this, and it breaks it up and it makes it more clear. So the Sanskrit, in fact, shows that the cha is a chair here, is if, rather than a. The Pali is ambiguous. You can read it either as and or as if. But from the Sanskrit, it must be if. And that actually allows us to make more sense of the sentence. So the first part of the sentence is conditional. But if for all that getting involved and grasping, mental fixation and insistence and underlying tendency, this person does not get attracted, grasp and fixate on the thought myself. All right? So this is hopefully where we are. This is like the state of the practitioner. All right. For all that, we have all of that stuff, getting involved, grasping, mental fixation, insistence, and underlying tendencies. That's where we're at. That's who we are. Yeah. But for all that, you still don't let yourself get attracted, grasp, and fixate on the thought myself. Yeah. So this is the position of us as practitioners of the Dhamma. All of those things are still there, but we don't let them control us. Yeah. That's what requires vigilance. That's what requires mindfulness, because that's what underlying tendencies do. They underlie things, and they're always pulling us in that direction. But we don't have to be controlled by those things. Then, if you don't let yourself fixate on the idea of myself, they'll have no doubt or uncertainty. When saying it, they have no doubt or uncertainty, this is a hint that we're now talking about the stream entering. Okay, stream enters, overcome doubt. That what arises is just suffering arises, and what ceases is just suffering ceasing. So here the Buddha is talking about the Four Noble Truths, the arising and cessation of suffering, but again, in a very distinctive and powerful way. And we think about that, like what arises is just suffering arises, and what suffering is just ceasing, suffering ceasing. Yeah. So this whole sutta has been looking at what exists, what does not exist, what is arising and what does not arise. And how do we get attached and we get involved with that? But if actually everything is just suffering, what is it that we're getting involved in? What is it that we're getting attached to? It's just suffering arising and suffering ceasing. It's a very profound statement. And like all profound statements, kind of disturbing and worrying, and makes you go, oh, I don't know what I don't know what's left if everything is suffering, right? And that's the key to a genuinely profound philosophical insight. Profound philosophical insights are not things that you post on Instagram to make yourself feel better. Maybe we should do that. Maybe you should make like a cushion out of it. We can crochet what arises, just suffering arising, what ceases, just suffering ceasing, and post that on Pinterest or something like that and see how it goes. It's kind of upsetting. Right, and you don't want to really admit that, yeah. And so the Buddha's saying that all of that discussion, like how you know the infinity of the world, the eternity of the world, do things really exist or they not exist, or who knows it, and all of those things is actually just suffering. All of those things are suffering. Then the Buddha says their knowledge of this is independent of others. So again, this is a key phrase in the suttas, referring to a stream enterer. So a stream enterer is the one who's seen the Dhamma, right? So because they've seen the Dhamma, then they don't have to rely on anyone's report about it. So this is something which is actually very profound in Buddhism, but also it's very simple, right? It just means like somebody says to you, that restaurant is really good food, and you say, oh, yeah, I know, I eat there all the time, right? You don't have to rely on their reports. You've seen it for yourself. So a stream enterer has seen the Dhamma. Right? What arises is just suffering arising, and what ceases is just suffering and ceasing. Their knowledge of this is independent of others. And this is the goal in Buddhism, right? So the goal of cults is to make everybody dependent on the cult leader and the cult, so that you are forever tied in and bound to it. But from Buddha's point of view, our goal is to make you independent. We want you to be able to solve your problems for yourself, right? And to be as independent. The truth is just there, up to us to realize it. Then the Buddha says, this is how right view is defined. All exist. This is one extreme. All does not exist. This is the second extreme. So as we've seen, all exist is the oldest cosmology, and all exist is the second cosmology. Avoiding these two extremes, the realized one teaches by the middle way, Majjhena Dhamma Desana. And so it seems that this phrase, Majjhena Desana, is the was a key phrase that was drawn on by Nagarjuna, who named his treatise the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. And there's been a lot of scholarly discussion on this. In fact, I was thinking whether maybe next week to even do a session on Nagarjuna. Anyway, I'm just going to put that out there. If anybody wants, we can do one on Nagarjuna next week. I'm just thinking about it. Venerable Upeka wants to participate in the thing.
Wanted to say yes, please. That's all.
You wanted to say yes, please. You didn't want to help me present the one on Nagarjuna?
I didn't want to help you present, but I would love to hear it.
Okay.
That was not accidental. Raising hand. That was just total excitement that ended up in a hand being raised.
Okay. So getting a few people saying yes to Nagarjuna. Okay. Maybe, well, I'll think about it. It would be problematic mainly because I would have to read it. I have to read it. I haven't read it for a while, so I'd have to like refresh myself and so on. But anyway, we will see. It's a difficult treatise. But anyway, it probably is a good idea to do it because it's a difficult treatise, but it actually draws out a lot of the things that we are discussing here today. Anyway, so this is the Kacchana Gotta Sutta. And within this very short scope of literally, it's just a few sentences actually, then it very elegantly presents a range of Dhamma teachings it presents like a philosophical context of them. It presents like that full kind of existential situation of the Dhamma that the Dhamma's expressing, but it also presents it in a psychological perspective, which is it's actually very practical and very handy sutta to understand for meditation as well. And it's also it also links the dependent origination and dependent origination and the theory of dependent origination with the realization of stream entry. And it's showing you how the realization of dependent origination is linked to the attainment of stream entry through understanding the origin and the cessation of the world. So these things which are often stated in the suttas but not necessarily linked up or shown the relationship between them. And as well as that, it also analyzes like the dynamic nature of the defilement and how we get attached and how we are acting within and despite the fact that we live within that world of attachment. And it also offers that promise of saying that we can let go and we can find those freedom from those doubts that are plaguing us, whether they are personal doubts, but also those existential and cosmological doubts about the universe, where we came from, and all of those things. So there's a huge range of depth that's found in this one particular sutta. And so you can see why, like I said, it's your favorite sutta nerd's favorite sutta, and was such a inspiration for Nagarjuna, and, you know, through Nagarjuna to the whole of Mahayana philosophy, especially Tibetan Buddhism. Okay, so that is the Kacchanagata Sutta. Any more questions, thoughts?
I just appreciate how that line, it's just suffering arising and
right
suffering
past. Dukkameva upajmanam upajati. Yeah. Yeah.
Simplifies it.
Right?
Is that referring to everything, every perception, or is it referring to
It's referring to everything. Yeah, in that particular case, right? So it's the suffering which is in everything, right? Which is caused by the defilements. Yeah. Because and it's caused by everything specifically because it doesn't partake, because it doesn't partake in that inherent existence that would be an eternal existence. So if there could be an eternal existence and we could live as gods, forever happy, right, and just enjoy that happiness of existence forever, then maybe not everything
recording has stopped,
but we live in a world where that isn't the case. And so because things are part of that process of conditionality, that means that they are changing, and that no matter what, the happiness, even the happiness of the gods, still is impermanent. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? Any questions here? No? Okay. If we have no more questions, we might wrap up for this evening. Thanks, everybody, for your attendance. And I hope that was enjoyable and instructive. We will be back next week, also here at the Temple of Humanity. We'll be on Wednesday nights at the Crow's Nest Center. Last Wednesday, Sydney was flooding, so only a few brave souls managed to make it out to the center, so good on them. Hopefully we'll have better weather this week. What else is coming up? That's about it, I think. In the next week. Thanks, Venerable Prasanna. Rain Bodhi at Green Square Library at 1:30 on Sunday. Okay. Green Square Library in Green Square, right? That's very convenient that they put it there. Right? Because they put it somewhere else, you wouldn't know where it was, right? So it's very good, very thoughtful. All right. So somebody's turned on their microphone. I'm not sure if they want to talk or they're just by mistake. Anyway, it's just by mistake. All right. Thanks, everybody. It's been an honor to share the Dhamma with you for this evening, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.